This episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes, changing how you see the network. Thousand Eyes shows you details of networks you don't own, such as the internet. Find out more at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers.
You can't do that in an enterprise. The enterprise doesn't work that way. What about our legacy environments? And no one wants to spend money on networking. It's just some of the common excuses as to why enterprise IT can't do new things in networking. Now, you know that here on Packet Pushers, we're always looking at the future. We're not looking backwards. My manager from back in the old days when I was a sales rep and I turned up to tell him why my numbers hadn't hit the forecast that I'd made, he said, "Greg, don't tell me what you did for me yesterday. Tell me what you're going to do for me tomorrow." And that's how Packet Pushers works. It's very much of the motto that we look when we're talking about content. It's about the future. And so when enterprise IT says we can't do new things, we can't see in the future, it's very interesting to talk to somebody who's actually doing new things in networking. So today we are joined by Peyton Maynard-Curran. He's the VP at UpChannel, and he's responsible for a whole bunch of networking for a very large wireless provider. Peyton?
Actually, we're not really a wireless provider. What we are is a company that's building with wireless providers to enable them to move into third world nations or into third tier markets in a way that makes economic sense, but also allows them to drive cost out while making more money, allowing them to have a closer relationship with their customer, but also allowing them to have more efficient operation processes.
Right. And you've got 20-odd years in networking across the board here. You've done a whole bunch of vendor-side and customer-side networks over that sort of time frame.
That's completely correct.
All right. So with that, we saw you give a presentation at the FutureNet conference a few weeks back. Those people who've been tuning in will know that Ethan and I were lucky enough to get an invite to this conference and to watch the presentation. And you were up on stage talking about how you see the future of networking. And in particular, you were quite critical of the vendors about, and I think your presentation boiled down to, the only thing a vendor is good for is a steak dinner, which seemed like harsh criticism to me.
Yeah, I think you can take it that way. But if you look at it, the way that networks have been sold, the way they've been developed, and the way that they have evolved hasn't really changed in the last 20 years since I started this. If you still think the way that requirements are built out for a product line manager at a networking company, they're really stack ranked against how much revenue am I going to make? And then that person has to balance around, you know, new relationships, old relationships, but they literally have to build something that is building a product channel of sales or a channel full of sales. They aren't really solving a problem. And what this has created is a disconnect between the problems we're trying to solve and how we solve them. You know, if we look at things like Calico, and we compare them to vendor-based SDN systems, those vendor-based SDN systems are completely complex. You know, having to build tunnels, why do I need to pack tunnels, whether it be NVGRE or whether it be VXLAN inside my data center, when all I'm really doing is controlling flow between servers? You know, why do I have to have a device, a hardware device, inside that flow as well, some sort of controlling system, a switch, a router, that's terminating all those tunnels and then telling it where to go? Again, I want server A to be able to talk to server B and maybe not be able to talk to server C. I mean, that's a very simple concept, and we can control that through access list and route manipulation. And Calico has proven that you can do that very, very easily, whereas these SDN systems that have been built by entrenched networking vendors have been built complex, because the more complex they are, building on the tools that they've had in the past, the more joined at the hip you are with the customer, and it's harder for them to move.
So, you know, taking the vendor's position here, if you look at tool solutions like ACI and NSX, what they're doing is dragging the legacy along behind them, right? The customers have said to vendors, this is what we've got. We can't let this go. We can't abandon this. We have to carry this forward. We have to integrate with this legacy in our data centers. So you can't just go and start doing something that pretends that doesn't exist. So the vendors are being driven by what their customers are asking for. What that intimates is that customers are asking for the wrong thing.
Well, so the question is, where are you getting the requirement from within the company? If it's from the network engineers, you're exactly right. They have to support an old deliverable with a system that's using some sort of old protocol that's been standing there forever. But if you ask the business itself, what they want is their product to work. And what we're seeing with this transition into cloud computing, and why, you know, the estimates are that 57% to 71% of all enterprises will be in cloud by 2018, is because they're saying, yeah, those requirements are there because I'm having to support an in data center system that's already deployed, and that's what my network guys tell me I have to have. Or I can go deploy this in Amazon or Oracle or any of the number of other cloud providers, and I can get the same service today without having any of those constraints, at least that I see.
So the enterprise would say to you, you know, if I'm an enterprise sales rep and I'm a vendor, they would say that every one of our customers is unique. Every use case is unique. They're always asking for something that's different. And so therefore, our products need to match what our customers want. Otherwise, they're not going to buy them from us. So what you're saying then is that in the public cloud where you have limited choice, that works too. That would fly in the face of what vendors would normally say.
Yeah, and that's actually a really great line from most salespeople. You know, everybody's unique, it's all different. I've actually had a sales guy tell me that certain packets won't work with certain routers. So it really creates a dynamic where salespeople are incentivized to talk about uniqueness and all the things that make each individual customer unique and why they have to make these specific choices. But let's look at the facts. You know, the feature set that's enabled on all these devices is built for a large audience, not for particular audiences. It is built to bring in the most money, not to bring in the littlest amount of money from one particular edge case. So they are building for a global bucket of things that make it valuable. What the cloud people have said, okay, let's pare those down to the things that are the most usable, the 95%, maybe even the 85%, and let's make those available without having to have the other thousands of features that all these network vendors are supporting, right? And that has made them really successful.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that one of the things I've learned from the public cloud is that their networks are incredibly simple and in some senses hard to use because they're missing features that I'm used to. So as a customer, I often get into, you know, you talk to people and they say, well, where's the IPsec VPN? Where's the DM VPN? Where's the, you know, a couple of years ago I was doing some work on the cloud and they only did point-to-point. And I'm going like, well, that doesn't make any sense. And they couldn't do pinned routing. You couldn't route between two IPsec tunnels. So that's why vendors exist. So vendors are saying, well, we offer the advanced features and the advanced capabilities because networks are inherently complex. They're inherently difficult. So we have to produce complex, difficult products to solve those problems.
I agree. I hear that they say that a lot. What I disagree with is the actual implementation of that. If you look at a majority of the complex nature of environments, it's because we built that complexity in because we didn't know another way to do it. And as you see more and more tunneling capabilities, as you see more and more traffic separation capabilities move to compute, I don't need that network device to do that anymore. I'll give you an example. I was at a large company, a gaming company, and you know, we came in and one of the first things we had to diagnose was why were our web pages falling over. And the problem was that the software that was written, pulling back into the databases, was actually DDoSing our own databases. So what was our solution? Was it to go rewrite the software in our data center so that it accessed the databases correctly? No, we put in F5 load balancers. Fast forward 4 years later, we still have a technology or an architecture that requires those F5 load balancers be in front of that architecture because we've gotten addicted to what the solution was. If we when we took that solution and finally put it into a cloud environment, did we have to worry about F5 load balancers anymore? No, we rewrote that software so that it did its job correctly in the environment of AWS. If we had taken that same methodology back into our own deployment architecture and not just stuck with our historical architecture, we would have had no need for those F5 load balancers anymore. So you see what I'm saying? There's sort of a trick and an egg. Sometimes I solve a problem because it's my immediate need and that becomes a historical legacy. And sometimes I just don't have any other idea how to solve the problem. So I go for these specialized devices.
But Peyton, you just made a... You said a huge mouthful there when you said, oh yeah, we just re-architected our software so that it would work the way it needs to work in AWS without having to stick an F5 load balancer in front of it. A lot of organizations seem stuck there where, well, the application works the way it works and you need to do magic in the network to resolve this. And so we do end up leaning on the vendors.
Yeah, it's always better when it's someone else's problem, right? No one ever got fired for buying Cisco, et cetera. And I agree with you. The majority of enterprise solutions in the past 5 years or enterprise environments, even currently, are going to still have that mentality, which is let's go lean on someone to give me a solution that makes this stuff work. Yeah. But what you're seeing is at the pace of innovation, these companies have to go and fix those problems because they can't actually make progress on what their core product is or on how to evolve that core product if they leave this legacy tech debt in place. They're going to get outpaced by competitors.
And I think that's key, is that if you don't keep up with what your competitor is doing, if you continue to run an obsolete technology model, Like if you continue to run 15-year-old routers instead of moving to SD-WAN, then your competitors are going to be able to be cheaper than you. They're going to be able to bring products to market faster than you. And so even though, you know, vendors go out and say to customers, why don't you upgrade? Why don't you transition to a new market? They're often not. Like customers are saying, why would I replace this equipment? What's causing us to not go and buy new equipment? Why is it perfectly acceptable in network to sit on a core switch for 15 years or 10 years or 15 years? Like somebody wrote an article today, God forfend, defending the CAT 6500 and saying how awesome it was and why we should totally, everybody should still be buying it. That was a product that came out in 1996. I mean, on one hand, great value for money that a product that's been, is 20 years old is still sitting in my data center. On the other hand, do you have the features and flexibility that you could have if you had something more modern?
Well, I think that that situation is being enabled by two things. And one's the more shock value one, which is I think that some people have gotten very latent and this thing works. It moves packets. What else do you need? At the same side, on the other side of that is that because compute is taking up more and more of the responsibilities of network load, meaning traffic separation, being able to do things like load balancing, DDoS mitigation on compute, why do you need anything different? You know, networks have put themselves in this place where if they don't evolve faster, compute's going to outscale them. So that exact situation you describe is going to be someone being able to use a 6500 as long as he wants, but they're going to need that thing less and less and less, other than just additional ports for new servers. Or they'll be able to find, eventually, a much more efficient, cost-efficient methodology to do that, and they'll move to something else. But that'll be probably the only thing that moves it, as long as network engineering stays in that perspective.
So one of the other parts of your presentation was talking about sales reps and vendors. And I think one of the topics that I've often talked about a lot, especially in our newsletter, is this idea that buying from vendors is actually just costly. And vendors sort of say to me, well, that's the way it takes. You have to teach customers what to buy and why they should buy it and how it's going to work for them. They're not... which is implicit in that statement is a fairly distasteful thing that actually rings true, which is that customers don't know what they want, they don't know why they want it, and they don't know how they're going to use it. So therefore, vendors need to have sales reps, they need to have sales engineers, they have vast amounts of money spent on marketing collateral to be able to convince customers that upgrading their network actually has value. That is, you know, that sometimes that seems to me like, well, that's just the way it is. Networks are complex. If you take on the argument that that technology is hard, therefore the vendor has to hold your hand. But there's a reverse side to that too, which is sales reps are just exploiting you and sucking up all your time. You know, where do you sit on that sort of spectrum of thought?
Well, I mean, when you think about enterprise networks, and just networks alone, we're talking about $300 billion of the $4 trillion enterprise market. It's a very small portion, but a lot of it is, you know, 60 to 80% gross margin. So it speaks exactly to what you're saying, which is they're really just sort of sucking money through a funnel that's just small enough to be important, large enough to be important, and just small enough to not be so important that everybody goes and investigates why these costs are so high. There are lots of questions around networks. If you think about even classically trained software engineers, they don't understand how the networks actually work because they've never had to. You know, I gave an example at my FutureNet talk about my air conditioner in Leesburg, Virginia that died in 2011. And when I went to fix it, I finally realized how messed up it was. I had the same purview as most software engineers around my air conditioner, which is if I press the button, it'll get colder. Most software engineers look at networks and expect to just be able to throw packets at it, and then it's going to take the most efficient route possible. It's going to work in the most efficient way possible. They don't realize they could drive large amounts of money and large amounts of cost out of the ecosystem if they were to do it a different way. Well, that's where the chicken and egg thing happens with cloud computing, which is, there are large sales cycles to go in and train Bubba network engineer on what our new technology is, how it applies, and then that network engineer has to get a director or a VP involved. They have to finally make a purchasing decision, and they have to understand why they're doing it, versus a software engineer, which is exactly what Bubba and his management team are supporting, getting everything deployed. A software engineer can go to AWS and sign up for a site right now, and as long as it supports all of the functions he needs, He's doing his job.
He's not bothered if it's inefficient. He's not bothered if there's features missing. He's not bothered if there's no QoS. Like, there's no QoS in the cloud. People sit there, you know, we spend many, many hours, many millions, trillions of dollars on quality of service configurations, supposedly because voice is going, won't work, you know, or critical traffic won't route. But in the cloud, this all seems to work without anybody doing anything about it. So,
because they just throw bandwidth at it, which is exactly what you should do in the first place. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at Time Warner Cable, we never really had to do quality of service because we just always had 150% of the bandwidth that we'd ever seen on our network. That meant that we'd never run out of bandwidth unless there was a massive DDoS event. So why do you need QoS in the first place? And you think about QoS and all the tools that you could list off that are, you know, could be configured on network devices that get solved by bandwidth. Those were there because we started with T1s and fractional T1s and DS3s when bandwidth was extremely valuable and it was hard to move packets from one router to the next. And this revolution of Ethernet and a revolution of data centers and cloud computing, that has been trivialized. I can now move those packets at so cheap a cost in comparison to previous iterations that it doesn't matter. Just throw more bandwidth at it and forget taking the time to do quality of service or to do any kind of RSVP solution that would actually have fixed it in the past.
Peyton, this brings up a question that keeps coming up in my mind as we're talking through this, and that is the idea of the network having values. Let me put some context around that. So once upon a time, VMware sold the hypervisor, and the hypervisor had value, but I think you could argue now that the hypervisor does not have value. There's several of them out there. That's not the magical thing. It's all these peripheral services around virtualization that are interesting and valuable, but not the hypervisor itself. Are we getting to a point with the network where the network, if we're really honest about it, isn't all that interesting and isn't all that valuable? Does the question make sense?
Yes, no, and you're completely right. Look, I'll throw out some numbers there that are not NDA protected, but as example numbers. You know, when I was buying switches at certain companies, we would go and we'd look at the cost, and we'll just give an example. It was $800 a 10 gig port. That cost now is well below 100, meaning I can buy switches that are extremely dense for 1/8 the cost that I used to, and that's, again, from a vendor. I can now also go directly to the switch manufacturers, the Celestica, the Acteons, the EdgeCores, and buy them for even 1/5 of that cost. The only thing that I am paying for really from a vendor is software that runs on top of that switch. So the network has lost value in the sense that it needs all this configuration and software from the Junipers or the Aristas or Ciscos or whoever. What it is valuable for is for moving packets. And if I look at it then from that perspective, that means I need to have a lot of ports, I need to have a lot of throughput capacity, and I need to have just the available infrastructure to move packet from point A to point B.
So you're saying minimizing your infrastructure is key?
Yes. And moving all the advanced features that you need to compute, where if I as a software organization see a problem with it, I can fix it right away. I mean, this whole conversation got started, Greg, because you posted something about the ESA that it fell over 213 days. Mm-hmm. You know, what happens in that situation? I report it, I ask for a fix, and I may or may not ever get that fix. Oh, by the way, I have to continually pay a maintenance contract on that ASA year after year after year to even have access to someone that can fix it. Mm-hmm. When that ASA is really just doing what? Access lists for me? Some sort of high-level layer for firewalling? All of that can be done on compute. And if the thing breaks, guess what? If I have the engineers that can fix it on hand, or if I'm participating in a community of people that are constantly looking at this, I can go get my solution today. Or be working tomorrow to my solution today or within the next sprint versus having to wait 60, 90, 180 days for a fix and just having to continually deal with that.
You're advocating for a network infrastructure that is, A, got the port density that you need, B, has the bandwidth that's required, and that C, is as simple as absolutely possible, pushing any complex features out to the edge where you might need to execute them and make the network as cheap and fast and again, simple as possible. And again, going back to the Project Calico comment early on, we've proven that, you know, with Project Calico, when there's at least one other, if not a few other open source projects that take this approach where there's no encapsulation of IP packets going around the network to isolate them from one another. There's access lists that control that instead. You do have a very simple network with a software layer on top that's controlling which endpoints have access to which other endpoints. You don't need VXLAN. You don't need all of the VXLAN to VLAN mappings. You don't need a control plane, which I was just got off a briefing with a vendor who was complaining that as they're trying to orchestrate other vendors' BGP EVPN solutions, they're not compatible. Cisco doesn't play with Juniper, for example, in this space right now. Things that are supposedly industry standard are not. And again, just going back to it's a lot of complexity that you can argue you don't need it all.
That's exactly right. And let's just think about what you described there. Let's talk about MPLS. MPLS has taken 11 plus years to implement to any kind of parity between all the different vendors. Why does it take that long? The EVPN solution that you were just talking about, why does it take that long for vendors to actually provide us a solution that interops with all my equipment, whether it be from vendor A or vendor B? They're not incentivized to do that. They want you to continue to buy their equipment. In fact, they want you to continue to buy more of that equipment. And one of the ways that they do that is by making it hard for you to work with other vendors' equipment and in infrastructures you've already deployed. I mean, that's a classic sales technique. Get someone hooked on some sort of proprietary protocol that they cannot do without and makes it impossible for them to move to another vendor.
Or at least makes it difficult enough for them to move. So sales rep loves that.
That's
because
right.
You can always move, but it's just there's a cost penalty to moving to the competitor. And so the incumbent then has an advantage. It's not that you can't move, it's just it makes it difficult.
And when all other arguments fail, talk about the cost of actually doing it. Yes. So that whole ecosystem has been sort of upended by cloud compute and upended by this idea that we could be doing things with open source software like Calico, by building software in ecosystems like SnapRouter, Platina, that allow us to actually do the coding ourselves.
Not a big fan of Calico. You keep bringing up Calico all the time. And my problem with Calico is, why use BGP to configure a vSwitch? That seems incredibly retarded to me. That seems like I'm going to use this protocol that was developed in the 1970s to configure a vSwitch in 2015. That just doesn't make sense.
You and I are completely on the same page, but the difference with Calico is I can actually participate in the project and change it, whereas I can't with Juniper or Cisco or anybody else.
Right, yeah. So if you go and get Contrail or ACI or any, VTS or any of the other SDN solutions from, big companies, and those solutions actually do have value, right? So let's not pretend that there are organizations who don't want to change the product, who don't have good quality staff or staff who are given permission to be flexible and creative and to solve challenges themselves. The company itself is led by managers who expect computers to work like cars. I go and buy a car, I drive it, when it's finished, I throw it back and get a new one. And they expect networks and computers to work the same way.
That's right.
And that's what vendors like, our ever-loving vendors, Cisco, Dell, HPE, that's the way they work. They want to solve the need. That's the need that they're meeting for certain customers.
That's right. The problem is, though, that needs, as we look at how software evolves and how we support just deployment ecosystems within data centers, it's no longer I spin up a bank of servers that last for 5 years and I tear the whole thing down. It's I want continuous compute all the time. That server is not going to be dedicated for one service. It's going to be dedicated for a bunch of services that can morph and change over time. And therefore, the network layer has to be extremely malleable to that as well. I can't be told I can't put a service in on that piece of hardware because it doesn't meet the network requirements. I want ubiquity everywhere. And so that's sort of changing that viewpoint, that it's not just a car doing a certain thing. It's a general purpose vehicle that delivers a lot of things.
So talking about the network sales cycle, so if I'm going to buy equipment, let's go back to this idea that we need vendor sales reps, we need reseller sales reps, we need reseller engineers, we need resources from Cisco, best designs. There are entire websites or sub-websites on the vendors talking about their enterprise technology and attempting to explain that. Is that really necessary? Is network selling hard for a reason?
I don't know if it's hard for a reason. I think there's a lot of history here that I don't want to discount at all. When you think about who invested in Cisco or Juniper or Extreme or all the various networking vendors that we've had over the last 20 years, remember Ascom Timeplex? You know, those things were extremely hard to understand, extremely hard to work with, because we as an industry hadn't really settled on or had the tools on how to actually control and manage devices like that. I mean, we're talking about moving from an analog world to a digital world, actually using analog mediums to actually move digital products. Like, it was so mind-bending at the time that it was very hard for people to understand, what am I doing? The problem was, about 10 years ago, they just stopped. You know, vendors found a very good formula that worked and said, okay, we're going to just keep doing this. Why would we want to push and innovate? I mean, if you look at things like SNMP and OpenNFV, these are things, tools that were supposed to make it easier for us to understand our networks and configure them. Mm. They're both terrible. You know, SNMP has been, you know, people, it's not a protocol. It doesn't work well. It can still knock over a router even in 2017. And OpenNFV, the vendors are only participating in it because they have to. I mean, there's literally a video of a Cisco PM saying, we are doing OpenNFV because we've been told we have to. That shows you that what people are trying to do is not innovate, but continue to reinvigorate the same old sales cycle.
But at the same time, vendors will tell you, and I've spoken to any number of management from vendors who say, our customers are not asking for this. So we're not building solutions. Customers are not asking us for Yang or NetConf. They're not saying they want more than SNMP. They don't want telemetry. It's only just become lately that vendors have kind of realized that what I call the Tesla effect, which is, you know, there's a company over there making Teslas and everybody's looking at it saying, I want a Tesla. They don't know why they want a Tesla and they don't actually understand, but it's now becoming like they have to catch up with Tesla in the same way that Ford and, you know, all the car and Audi and BMW have to catch up, not because their customers are asking them for electric cars, but because Tesla's showing that there's a better car out there. And I do wonder if there's a transition here that's coming through.
Well, and I think that the example used is actually really good, because, you know, who was the first person to say, if I did what my customers, or if I built what my customers asked for, I'd build faster horses? You know, that was Henry Ford, right? And again, the customers that we're interacting with, again, are coming from a legacy network perspective. They're trying to build a better thing that they've already built. They're not looking at, how do I take that thing and actually, in some ways, destroy it? You know, how do I take extremely complex networks and make them extremely flat and simple? How do I take devices that used to cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars and pay thousands of dollars for it? And how do I get the same performance? How do I get the same features and functionality out of an open source ecosystem when I used to have all these program managers and engineers from Cisco and the other vendors supporting me? That ecosystem will actually become less and less valuable if people move this direction.
It's part of the problem with people... It's part of the problem with people moving to cloud broadly, because a lot of folks are saying, oh, okay, I'm going to move to cloud. How do I take what I've got in my data center and make it look exactly the same, just in the cloud instead?
Exactly. And not take advantage of any of the tools the cloud would offer to make it more efficient, but just rebuild the same problems they'd have in the past. You know, there was a technology called RFOG, RF over glass, that came out a few years ago. And the idea was, let's take all the inefficiencies of DOCSIS, CMTS, and put that on glass, on fiber. And it got immediately rejected by the industry because of that problem. We'd taken a problem that we historically had lived with and moved it into a medium that could have solved all those issues in various different ways, but we took all those problems with us. We see that happen in networks all the time. People have been operating in the same way for a long time, and so they continually shift their problems into new technology spaces that can solve them, but they don't
because
solve
change
them.
Is hard. And so we've got two groups of people that don't want to change or are struggling to change. You've got vendors who don't want to change their sales cycle. They want to keep selling nice, expensive network boxes. And you've got folks on the consuming those products who are used to the way things have been for a long time, and they don't really want to change either. And in fact, if you look at people that are doing brand new companies and building them all on cloud, then they are starting fresh and not... They're not trapped by any legacy processes or operations and getting things done more quickly and efficiently because they're starting from the ground up.
Well, I mean, and there are great examples. Like, let's take Fastly. This is a software company that's an edge compute CDN company that didn't really have many network engineers when they started, and they rethought the network from a software engineer perspective. They went out and bought Arista switches that couldn't even support BGP, or at least could not support a full route load for the internet route table. And they offloaded all the features they couldn't actually have happen on those switches onto servers. And they've continually iterated on that. Every time they've needed a new feature or they needed to upgrade a switch, they did it through the servers versus doing it through the switches. And that's completely changed the way that they look at networks.
Well, most of the IXPs in the world today no longer implement route reflection on routers. They set up BGP switches. Route reflectors servers. On servers.
That's right.
And then all of the switches, all the routers inside of the Internet Exchange just do BGP route reflection off a piece of software. So the real BGP functionality is not in the switch or the router. It's actually going on a server, and that's because they can program and script the BGP instance on the server, not on the switch. And that's the way you want it to work. And I do kind of, think that, maybe NetConf and Yang, the vendors, would tell me, well, we're working hard on our NetConf implementation so that you can move the programmability onto the hardware, onto the device, onto the router. But I'm not sure that customers understand the impact of that, because once you're doing software on the hardware, your software and hardware become linked. So when you run a proprietary operating system on a proprietary ASIC, like your average router from your favorite vendor, you get your operating system that's on there, but gets very restricted. You have to wait for the hardware. Only that vendor can iterate that operating system and the applications that run on it. So if you wanted to add something to the BGP to do, add a TLV because you wanted to try something out, you can't do that. And there's no way to convince a vendor to do that for you unless you've got a $500 million purchase in the pipeline. You get a once-in-a-lifetime chance to infect the vendor path. So.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually what the revolution of merchant silicon has enabled. If I can build everything towards a Broadcom spec, whether that be a Trident or a Tomahawk or Jericho, then I don't have to worry about that anymore. And that sort of is very freeing at that point. And, you saw Cisco and Juniper actually take this experiment a few years ago when they got rid of their own custom chips and went with EasyChip. Now, they've rotated back, and I think that there are some locations inside networks that are moving lots and lots of packets that need specialized silicon, but that space is getting smaller and smaller. And especially as the Broadcom chipset is able to handle more and more traffic and obviously more and more port density. I'd never have told you even 3 years ago that I can put 64 100 gig ports into 2RU and that I can actually fan that out into 10 gig ports, 640 10 gig ports. That's just crazy. The amount of traffic that I can push those switches today, and then even interlacing them between multiple switches so I get a matrix that's fully redundant is something we've never really seen before. And that upstep in capability of these switches is really starting to challenge service provider routing. And you add on top of that the ability to build my own features as I need them, or to remove feature bloat, remove all the features that I don't need out of a software stack. That's extremely attractive to a lot of organizations, especially if they have to continue to maintain their own infrastructure.
ThousandEyes, our sponsor today, says that they change how you see the network. And as someone who's spent many hours with their product, that's not just a tedious marketing claim from yet another monitoring company. Rather, ThousandEyes gives you insight into the parts of the network that you don't own, but that your critical services run across anyway. Imagine being able to monitor in detail the internet between you and your customers, or between you and your SaaS providers. With ThousandEyes, you can do exactly that. You will be able to see every individual router between you and the target you're monitoring, along with a historical view of the BGP state, alternate paths, as well as latency and loss metrics all across the internet, that network you do not own. The monitoring tests are run via ThousandEyes Cloud Agents, enterprise agents that you place at useful spots in your infrastructure or on endpoints like laptops. So you can get a true end-to-end graph of a path no matter where it starts and ends, inside your network or outside of your network. You can go up the stack as well. Do things like track CDN performance, look at DDoS attack and analyze it. Check out DNS server errors. Look at issues within your ISP's network using internet outage detection, which is a really cool ThousandEyes feature. You can measure mean opinion scores for VoIP paths and do in-depth web transaction monitoring to find out why that web server really is slow. And all these features are available through an intuitive interface that you drill into to get right to the root cause of the problem. When the root cause is spotted, you can then create a shareable report, which is really handy when you want to share what you found with that upstream third party that you might not have a business relationship with. If you are interested in ThousandEyes, you can check them out at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers. Sign up there for a free trial and a free t-shirt. So Peyton, in our conversation that we've talked about, you know, simplicity and leveraging cloud and so on. So as you look at what the network should be, you know, you're arguing for that simplicity and so on, and kind of holding up cloud as a model maybe of how that's done. Are you suggesting that maybe we should just be looking at our applications, retooling them to fit the cloud model and just move the heck to cloud and get out of the infrastructure business? Now, I'm asking that just because there's a lot of people that have said, you're not good at infrastructure, you enterprise company. Why are you spending your money there? You don't add value there. Let the people that are good at infrastructure do infrastructure and just move your stuff to cloud.
I think if you're going to do anything, you should be the best at it. And what we've seen traditionally from enterprise companies is that when it comes to infrastructure, they're not. Because, you know, when you take the idea of building something in software and you translate it to the network, the idea has been the network's easy. It's always easy. You know, you go buy this one thing and it's all going to work. And that's, in some ways, that's the way it's been. While they say it's hard, a lot of networking companies have come back with, you know, this is easy. We have the product suite that makes this work. Here you go. And we'll give you all the help you need to make it work, VAR model, all those sorts of things. But the history and the evidence really just doesn't add up for that. What has become really obvious is that a majority of enterprise networks do need to move to the cloud. They need to take out of their equation the time it takes to build networks, the time it takes to maintain them, and the time it takes to recover from outages, or the time it takes to build new features for the networks. There will always be a sliver of enterprise networks that have a real need for data center space and for infrastructure deployments. Completely agree with that. And what I'm saying to them is that they should get really smart people working on those problems. And they should start figuring out how to value and grade those infrastructure projects that they have so that they're really successful versus what we've done in the past, which is throw money at it.
Well, now, it's one thing to say moving to cloud, but because I think that implies three different things. You know, one is training. What I'm finding as someone with a long career of building infrastructure across several different technology silos, that as I begin to explore how you do things in AWS, for example, it's a major mind shift. You have to think differently and understand a whole raft of services and how they fit together to leverage them properly. So there's the training is one aspect. Then another is, once you understand how to use that infrastructure, now you've got operational processes that have to change, which can be an extremely big shift for organizations, particularly if they've got a lot of complexity in delivering their applications to their end users. And then third, you're talking about retooling of applications, as we talked about earlier in the show. So that's actually a really big deal to do it well.
It can be. It, again, and also the historic, how have we built our applications in the past and how convoluted or complex are they, and how does that lend itself towards the cloud? And I completely agree with you. If we take it on the face of it, that is a challenge that most people may not want to take on. The question comes back to velocity. How quickly can you continue to maintain and support the infrastructure that you have and still continue to build new features, to build new things that your customers want, to continue to provide value? If you know what your feature set is for the next 10 years and you never need to change anything, then move into cloud is not really a good idea for you. But if you're in a competitive environment where you're trying to actually deliver features in software to an end customer, and the network is continually something that's slowing you down, the cloud actually becomes much more attractive. Again, it is the idea that I have a set of rules that I can operate in, and I know how these things are going to perform, that is very attractive to software engineers. Because if we go into our own infrastructures, we do find lots of times when software engineers run into issues where their own network doesn't perform as it should. And what you've got at AWS is a huge amount of test customers continually telling you, this is how it will work. Whereas if it's on your own infrastructure,
because
you're there to find
the
traps
common
yourself.
Infrastructure with everyone else that's a cloud user. And yes, you're segmented from them, but in effect, everyone's sharing the same physical infrastructure. And so if it's working well for 150 other customers, it's going to work well for you in your little corner of the cloud.
That's correct. And look, all the lessons that can be learned in the community that can be built around that cloud ecosystem is much better than just you and your team in the infrastructure that you have yourself. Again, I'm not advocating that infrastructure will ever go away for privately owned infrastructure will ever go away for particular companies. What I am advocating is that those become less and less valuable unless they are completely required. People are going to want to have the littlest amount of infrastructure possible because, again, infrastructure is there to get you access to compute and to the tools you need that compute to deliver your service. And if I can make all of that happen in 15 minutes on the AWS website or the Oracle website or the Google website or anybody else, why wouldn't I do that versus waiting? You know, remember, delivery times for some of these switches can be up to 30 days to 90 days. So if I need to deploy something all new in a data center, we're talking about a month-long process. And then there's the cabling, and then there's the troubleshooting, and then there's everything getting turned up. Why would I wait 60, 90, maybe 180 days when I can do it in 15 minutes?
So now if I'm an enterprise and I'm in this situation of it's time for a refresh cycle or it's time for some kind of a change, you know, we're questioning how we do business. And of course, my vendors are going to be involved in that conversation. What is the stance? I mean, is there language or an approach you've taken with vendors to help them realize, hey, we're making some big changes here and, you know, and then manage their expectations?
That's a very hard perspective to take because what you're doing in that situation is you're talking about literally changing, moving the ground underneath some vendor ecosystems. And it's hard to understand how that relationship continues to move forward if there's an expectation that your spend is always going to grow. And so what you have to do is you have to talk about the things that are impacting your choices. You have to talk about, you know, how do we solve these problems in faster ways? How do we get to a situation where I am in more control, my organization is in more control of its own digital future, its own destiny, versus having to continually rely on a somewhat not always there partner. And you have to do it in a way that lets them know that, look, what we're seeing is infrastructure is awesome. Infrastructure I don't own and that meets a 4.9 or 5.9 criteria that has a wealth of information around it is even awesomer. And you just have to continually talk to them about it. The other thing that you have to do is really sort of run the numbers for yourself and show the organization internally, these are the why we're making the changes, and get people invested in what those numbers mean. And numbers aren't just cash. Numbers are also deploy cycles, downtime, time to...
Yeah, but most people don't have that skill. Like most enterprise IT managers were, 5 years ago, they were engineers, you know, operating the infrastructure. They didn't learn accounting.
A lot of enterprise engineering managers were never engineers.
they were music majors, such as right. Equifax's, you know, CS, Chief Security Officer. And, you know, it's not that they can't learn or adapt, but they're often just not equipped to make these transitions. And they're often very poor buyers of technology because they don't understand it, but they also have very poor understanding of buying, you know, spending large sums of money at scale and understanding legal terms and conditions. So it's all well and good to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, you come back to buying from the mainstream vendors, from Arista and Dell, because you know, they offer you a safe way to buy and they theoretically stand behind it in the same way that people want to buy a BMW or a Mercedes because they stand behind their car. And people are willing to pay over the odds. Like in Germany, a BMW is a middle-of-the-road family car. It is not a premium vehicle in any way, shape, or form. But BMW can drive that exact same car out of the country, maybe put some sparkly paint on it, and sell it at a 40 or 50% markup in the U.S. because it's a premium lifestyle vehicle.
Yeah, I actually had this conversation with an engineering team where we were looking at Quanta as a vendor to be able to do basically OCP compute for us. So we could buy our compute at 30 to 40% off in comparison to buying it from other vendors. Mm. And the engineering, one of the engineering managers actually looked at me and said, we only buy the best, which means Dell and HP. Why would we buy something from someone in some garage
that's building this OCP stuff? To just, because of brand name, say, quote unquote, that's the best. That's
And that's exactly the point. What you're going to find is, you know, through attrition that's going to happen in general, the companies that continue to follow those methodologies are going to fail, or they're just going to sort of continue down the path. And the numbers around moving to cloud computing, the numbers to using integrators like Quanta or going directly to switching vendors you use for self, are going to become so dramatic that those ecosystems are going to fail on their own. And it's just going to take time.
Yeah, but then again, these big vendors, our incumbent vendors that we have today, say, we are customer-driven. We make what our customers ask. And when you're making 65%, 80% profit margins like you are, well, servers don't make those sorts of margins. They're down around the 20%, 25% bracket. But, you know, when you're making products that customers ask for and you're shipping them, it's very difficult to say, how do I solve this problem for 5 years' time when everybody wakes up and realizes there's a solution out there that's half the price? I mean, why haven't we seen vendors come out with cloud, private cloud solutions that work just like AWS or Google Compute? Why can't we build private clouds that look like that? You know, we're 5 years into the public cloud transition. Why isn't there a private cloud solution? Is it impossible to do, or is it just because customers aren't asking for it? What's your experience in that space?
Well, I think we have actually. So Cisco came out with a cloud solution. I think it was called InterCloud.
Yeah, it came and went. Yeah.
Do you remember that experiment?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They did $1 billion to $2 billion worth of investment into InterCloud and shuttered it last year, I believe. Maybe it was even last December. I think that this does talk to the systemic environment that we put ourselves in, which is all the things that we've been talking about have been swirling around an ecosystem where. We're not going to innovate on software. We're going to innovate on hardware product. And when Cisco built their cloud solution, from what I understand, and I may be incorrect here, I want to be very clear about that, it was exactly what you would expect from a networking company, which was very hard on features, meaning NVGRE, looking for very discrete ways to make things happen through network control signals. The network was the primary function, and it didn't. It was not very flexible. You know, there weren't features I could drive into this cloud solution because it was so tenuous on its own that it didn't succeed, and it really couldn't provide anything else that people could do in AWS. And at the same time, AWS did exactly what Amazon has been really good at, which is create very open conversations about technology, where if you look at Cisco, who has been one of the best marketers around how to go get your CCNA and CCNP and CCIE, it still was not an open conversation with a larger ecosystem. It was still focused toward network engineers. If we continue to think that way from a vendor standpoint, I can see a situation where the vendors that we talk about today may not be around in the next 5 to 6 years. Or not in the same instantiation that we see them. And we've already seen this happening. You know, Nokia gobbled up Alcatel, which gobbled up Lucent, Ciena, all the different variances of companies that are BlackBerry has gone and went and back again.
Cisco, which is, of course, the networking company, looks less and less like a networking company because they have servers and storage. An IoT platform. You know, they're getting into communications. They're a voice company. They're doing Slack competitors and so forth. And
that's right.
That is actually a sign, I think, that Cisco knows as an organization that the networking is coming to an end over time in its current form, or at least it's not going to be the only source of revenue for them and they have to move away. Right. And it seems amazing to me that they're kind of saying this market is done. We need to have other things. And they're not growing, by the way. They're still the same size as they've been for the last 10 years in terms of revenue.
They're
still a $50 billion company. They still turn over the same revenue today as they did 10 years ago in terms of gross numbers. But increasingly, less and less of that money comes from enterprise or service providers. It comes from other businesses that aren't in networking anymore.
That's right. That's right. And you also see them sort of hedging bets in a lot of places that leverage network and also are leveraging companies that have had a historic business relationship with them versus being inventive and sort of taking on a moonshot like what Amazon did with AWS.
But then again, even so, look at HPE. We've seen them do any number of projects literally called Moonshot, servers full of ARM CPUs and HP's done dozens of them, MRAM and the Memristor and, lots of this, and fail substantially, commit significant resources and even go public with them to a lesser or greater degree and do very badly. Cisco dabbled in the storage industry with its Invicta product and failed. A lot of people got hurt by that. Guaranteed.
And think about it this way. Think about the complexity of all those solutions. I mean, they were either extremely over the top or they were just extremely complex on how you implemented it. And those vendors expected that their brand name would make it the thing that everybody wants. And again, I come back to simplicity has always won. And Amazon comes to you with two or three or four services. Same with GCP, same with Oracle, same with anyone else that's out there. And it just works. And people use that because it's predictable and it's something they can go get right away versus going and getting a Ferrari and trying to tow your boat with it.
Well, you could get somebody to custom make you a tow bar.
You totally could. I'm sure there's a network engineer that could do that for you.
But, not the best use of your Ferrari ever. In the Ferrari world, you would have another car just to tow your boat. Is actually how mainstream vendors work. They would say, this is a Ferrari. What you now need is another product to tow a boat. So we'll sell you two cars.
That's right? Exactly right. And I do want to highlight one thing that we've just sort of danced around here. There is a problem with how people look at networks from a management perspective. I've dealt with managers that didn't understand how the network worked. And it is very easy for a sales team to come in and sort of talk until their eyes glaze over and they walk out of the room and say, well, those guys must be right. And that is because a lot of the networking leadership is, again, not coming from networking. It is coming from a software group because software is what is actually making things happen. And the network is becoming more and more of a function of how do I get to deliver my software. This is not the case, obviously, at a Comcast or an AT&T, someone where the network is the product. This is always a situation in locations where the network is a derivative of the product or an underlining requirement to make that product work. But that same environment, enterprise environments, will lend itself more and more to simplicity and speed. And that's why, again, I keep coming back to, if I can go get something done in 15 minutes or a day or 2 weeks, when it will take me just 180 days to deploy it, the other solution, I'm more than likely going to lean towards the first solution.
So why aren't vendors moving to simplify their products, to make it easier to buy products, to reduce the sales cycle, and to do that? Why are they staying with the current business models? Like, John Chambers was basically a salesman. His whole managerial process was to hire more sales reps than any other company and get them out with the resellers in front of the customers and make sure the customers don't go anywhere else. The product was actually secondary to the sales,
which is why did the HP public cloud effort fail? And Cisco with the same question.
So the Cisco one, I think they had one paying customer, as far as I've been informed, and that may be incorrect. I don't want to try to say that I know what that answer is. But again, I think that as well as HP, things became too complex. If you look at the tool sets and how you would set things up and how you would actually get service instantiated, it wasn't me logging into the AWS website and turning on a service. It was I had to deal with a sales rep who would set up an account for me, who would get all the billing stuff taken care of in the background. And when that was all finally done, I could go to try to turn up a service. And if it didn't work because something was mistyped, I had to go back through the whole solution again. Do you understand how hard that ecosystem is compared to me just putting in a credit card number at AWS? And you also asked, Greg, why haven't people tried to make it easier? Well, because the whole ecosystem is propped up around an environment where we have the sales guy. I mean, if you think about it in a VAR solution, you've got the VAR sales guy and the VAR sales engineer, and you've got the sales guy from the networking vendor and their sales engineer, and you've got the whole VAR team that's there to support when your team doesn't know how to get something deployed. You have product managers and vice presidents in sales networking component that's also supporting you. All of those are deriving some value, an ecosystem that has been there for a long time, to allow them to sell and to allow them to make money and allow them to get paid, quite frankly, around that ecosystem. None of them want to see that go. None of them want to see you actually log into a website and order your product today and know that it'll be shipping there in the next 5 to 6 weeks. And you can use a credit card or a PO number that you already have established and cut out all the middleman. Nobody wants to see the whole sales engineering group go because everything is now developed on software. They want you to have to use their smart people to get this stuff done. And again, that is from an ecosystem that had to be built that way back in the 80s and 90s, but really hasn't transitioned.
It's another version of the problem, automation is taking my job.
That's right.
You know, these are all big company problems. So, any big company has these problems, and this is where Clayton Christensen's disruption theory comes in. He says, you know, when you're running a big company and something comes along that starts eating away from your customer base from the bottom up, which is what public cloud is doing. It's taking away the startups. And then of a sudden the startups turn into small companies. And now some of the big companies are putting small projects into the cloud. If you're defending that market, then how do you win against the predator, the person who's taking away your market? And I think the vendors have done some changes. They're starting to accelerate their product cycles. We've seen HPE do some changes where they discarded a lot of the legacy business units as they try to lean down and focus onto what the future will look like. But we haven't necessarily seen that happening at Dell or at Cisco. Dell got bigger, but it kept the same model. It's still producing the same technology, but by getting bigger and operating at scale, theoretically it gets more profitable because as it gets bigger and larger and owns more market share, it produces cheaper. Its cost of manufacturing reduces. But Cisco's taken a view of, I believe, that its way out of this is to partner with as many people as possible. So it's going to continue to do what it's doing, but it's going to look to partner with as many vendors, deepen the partnerships with companies like F5 and Palo Alto and Checkpoint and bring their software on top of the Cisco platform to try and add value. But I think at the same time, it also hides the value. Whose product are you using? If you're using Checkpoint on top of a Cisco platform, who's your key value state? Right. Where's your value proposition? So, and then the sales cycle gets even more difficult and the tech support gets harder because now if you're running third-party products on top of somebody's platform and you're managing them with this platform, who's going to support them? And the value of those products reduces and the public cloud starts to look even better again.
That's right. The more complex you make,
I think that's the point that you would make.
That's right. The more complex the sales cycle, the more complex the support cycle and support methodologies, the more people are going to drive towards simpler systems. And everything you described, whether it be a Checkpoint or it be an Arbor system, all those systems can be transitioned over to compute. I mean, Arbor even has a solution that runs on common compute versus having to buy their specialty hardware now. And more companies are deriving that as well. Why would I buy a Cisco, a Juniper, a Nokia, and then put someone else's technology on top of it and not even understand how all that stuff works together? You know, I also find that if you take a slot in a router and I put a specialty piece of equipment in there that's going to run a Checkpoint, that thing usually runs at half the throughput of what the slot can actually do because they're trying to do some data and crunching on that, it doesn't really work as well as a good server. So if I'm going to waste half my slot capacity, why don't I just put a Ethernet blade into that and get my slot capacity back and then run it as a server standing next to that router?
Yeah. And then who's supporting it?
That's right.
We've seen too many times that vendors sit there and say, well, it's not on a platform that suits my needs, or, you know, we can't support that. You now you need to go and talk to the other. And so, and even when they do try and take on the and say, you know, we support it end-to-end, there's still always a bit of a challenge somewhere in the middle as to who's responsible for what. Yeah.
Or even how do you supply tools that actually know that it's working? You know, if you look at the type of tools that the industry generates, they're extremely monolithic. A lot of them still built on old Solaris systems. Or, you know, if you think about Cisco LMS or any of the other enterprise management suites, they really provide me a very small amount of information. Again, they're built on things like SNMP. It's late. I'm not getting all the data I want. And as a network engineer, I'm looking at servers that can HTTP live stream every single data point that's pushing through that server at the same time that it's serving its function. Why can't I paid $10,000 for that server. I just paid $1 million for this router. Why can't the router do the same thing? So there's also that disparity in how I even know how my ecosystem is working from a network engineer to a software engineer perspective.
Oh, man, monitoring and tooling, that's a whole big conversation. We're still talking to vendors
who are very excited
about the feature in their SNMP polling solution. And then you get kind of sad trombone. But then you go, but they got a market. There are actually a lot of people that are going to think this is really cool and buy this.
Well, you know, one of the things that you guys brought up when we were having these conversations was our customers still ask for CLI and SNMP. And I'd actually turn that statement around and I'd say, we've never been offered anything else. We've actually started OpenNFV and many different instantiations of where we could move ways of configuring devices and also understanding how those devices are operating into a much more efficient system. And vendors have been resistant to allow it to happen. And then they throw it back to us that, well, nobody else is asking for this. But we have a whole initiative around changing it. But the vendor's like, oh, we don't need it because nobody asked for it. So I don't really understand how that is actually true when we have large industry presence of people asking for something different.
But then again, the people who are large enough and smart enough to ask for those solutions are often people that just leave the ecosystem completely. And what I mean by that is they might be just saying, well, all future projects are in the public cloud. We're moving to Google or, you know, Rackspace or... Yeah, that's right. Or you're seeing something else happening where they're saying, well, I'll start to do what you've done, Peyton, which is I'll start to buy OCP-related hardware. I'll start to roll my own. I'll go and recruit the people that I need to be able to, have the networking and the server and the software developers to automate my infrastructure and make OpenStack work or Kubernetes work or whatever it is and do it myself. And I just wonder how big that gap's going to get in the years ahead.
Well, especially as you said, as more entrenched, established companies are starting to fall to the wayside because of the pressure of startups that become companies, that become bigger companies, that become even really bigger companies. And also as you see companies like Google and Facebook and AWS innovate, you know, one of the things that we also have to explore is what is the impact of people moving into AWS because of the overall network spend? Meaning if I take 10 companies, how much would they have spent to do it on their own versus how much does Amazon spend to support those 10 companies? And what I think you'll find is that Amazon's going to spend a tenth of what it costs to support those 10 companies if they'd done it on their own. They don't need as many switches. They don't need as many routers. They don't need firewalls because they do that on compute. And they're buying all this stuff at scale anyway, so they're getting great discounts. Whereas the enterprise person is going to spend top dollar. So that's going to have a huge impact on what features and what the sales strategy is and all of those things for companies like Cisco and really going to start to force change around how they start to approach these markets.
Well, you know, and I think vendors are starting to make that change. Now, keep in mind, vendors are going to be slow to change. They're multi-billion dollar organizations. They have product pipelines that, you know, 5 and 10 years deep, you know, and they will tell me that they are changing. Look at this new product we've just announced today. Is that not signs of change? And I think the risk that I might take sometimes is that, no, that's not enough change. When I look around elsewhere, I see far more change. People are starting to put network adapters in servers that actually have full-on processors, like smart NICs, right?
Yep. And
But that in the enterprise, people just go, I don't need that. There's no reason for me to have more than 1 gig. The gap between, you know, what they think is the reality and where they need to be, they should be buying hardware with these fancy NICs because the extra performance just lights up the server. It gives it an extra 25% throughput. But they're saying, you know, well, when I poll my switch on SNMP, I'm not even using 1 gig. Why would I buy a 25 gig smart NIC? And I just have to put my head on the desk and go, oh, sad.
Yeah. and look, battleships are battleships. They're going to continue to sail. They're big things. They're hard to turn. And when I say battleships, I'm talking about large established companies. Everybody says it's so hard to turn the battleship. The problem is that what we're finding is the democratization of technology is allowing one torpedo from a startup to destroy that whole battleship. And if people don't realize that tension between delivering product and delivering value to their customers, is more important than continually maintaining old established ways of doing work. That's where you're going to see a lot of change in the entire industry. You know, you can look at it from everything from sports channels, where ESPN is charging $7.86 per customer, and the next lowest sports channel is paying $1.25 per customer. But I get the same thing from Fox Sports 1 that I get from ESPN. So why would I pay for both? You know, to technology companies where I can buy a switch for $50,000 from an entrenched vendor or established vendor, or I can go buy that same exact switch with the same exact chipset, the same exact capabilities for $5,500 directly from the manufacturer. And the only thing I have to do is figure out how to put software on it. And you do see companies like Juniper and Cisco realizing this. I can actually license Juniper software and put it on my white label switches now. So now I'm not even having to pay the hardware costs.
I mean, there are signs of change, so it's not hopeless. Yep. But, you know, you're sort of painting a view that the transition to the future is already here. You've moved away from the traditional vendors for some part, if not all. You said before that you've moved most of your stuff into the public cloud for the network you're building out.
Yeah.
How does that look? Is that an operational platform that's in the cloud managing devices that are in the field, and that's the lowest cost way forward?
Actually, what we do is we do embed a small amount of infrastructure inside our customers' infrastructure so that we can pull data out securely and then have a secure communication path back into the cloud. Security is one of the top requirements as far as we're concerned around the product that we're offering. But that infrastructure is very, very light. We're talking 4 or 5 servers and a switch, maybe, if we can't write on top of the switch that's already available from our customer. But then everything else is cloud-based, and I can do things like encryption inside software. I can do things like tunneling inside software from compute. The communication capability and the security capability is ubiquitous as far as we're concerned, between doing it in an AWS or GCP instance and then having our light installation at the customer.
Well, I think we're probably going to wrap this discussion up at this point. Hopefully we've done some justice to the fact that, you know, this open source and white box is a way forward, and that there is a role for vendors to play for some people, but increasingly the open source and white box route that Peyton's talking about and his experiences of it is a choice that some companies can make. And hopefully we've discussed all of those issues. You got any closing thoughts?
Peyton, towards the end there, said one startup company can torpedo a battleship these days. You know, the democratization of infrastructure. And everyone's got to be aware that they can vote in that democratization. I think some companies haven't quite grasped the fact yet just how diverse the choices have become. And when that waking up happens, it's the marketplace that's already interesting is going to get even more interesting. As we see the big battleships start to, battleships in the term of vendors here, begin to maybe lose even more market share and so on.
Yeah. Well, I think too, we need to look back at that 10 years of stagnation we had from the mid-2000s to the mid-2010s. You know, you could argue it's from 2000 to 2012, something like that. And that was largely driven by the fact, I think, in my personal view, that networking was good enough for all the needs that we had for it. We didn't need more than gigabit. We didn't need more than, you know, performance. We had fiber channel for storage, so we didn't have to worry about storage requirements on our Ethernet networks. The WAN was okay with MPLS, you know, blah, blah, blah. Everything was okay. There was nothing driving change. And what we've seen come along is a sudden transition where CPUs are now faster than the networks. And it's certainly possible with Intel servers, especially with things like DPDK and now the FPGA engines that are coming out, where you no longer need a hardware appliance to drive a firewall at 1 gig. You can do 10 gig or 40 gig firewalls on an Intel x86. And I think that's driving a whole bunch of transitions out in networking. Networking doesn't want to change. It's been static for so long that all of a sudden change has become hard. And that's not new. That's a normal experience for businesses. Peyton, have you got any closing thoughts for us before we hit the wrap?
No, I haven't. Thank you so much for inviting me. And this has been a great conversation. I think that you're both correct that we're going to see a lot of change happening in the next few years. And it's going to be awesome to participate in that.
Well, thanks for listening for Packet Pushers today. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Just a note, we are moving to SSL encryption on the website and on the podcatcher feeds. Now, last time we did this, we did have some problems with this. And so what we wanted to do is start flagging it to you. If you've got a podcatcher, start thinking about modernizing it or updating it. If you've got something that's a couple of years old, that's where we had the problems last time because we had SSL enabled and a lot of podcatchers couldn't make the transition. So be warned, maybe keep an eye out that if your feed stops working, it's not because we don't love you, it's just because we have to modernize and move to a encrypted world because the Google says we have to. As always, you can follow us on the Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on the LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on the Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.